As an extension of our consideration of cooperative interactions, we'll now turn to symbioses or symbiotic interactions. Now, a symbiotic interaction is an interaction that occurs between two organisms, and it's typically a very intimate interaction. Often one of the organisms is smaller, while the other is a larger organism, such as a microorganism living inside of, for example, an animal's gut would be an example of a symbiosis. Now, not all symbioses are cooperative, and in fact, there are a number of symbioses that are anything but cooperative when you have parasites interacting with host organisms, for example. And this is something that we'll see in the next chapter, not this one. In this chapter, we're going to emphasize particularly the interaction between organisms that are cooperative in either symbiotic interactions or a special case of symbiotic interactions, which are endosymbiotic interactions. We'll break the talk up into two parts. One part will be on symbioses between microorganisms or microorganisms and larger organisms, and the other second part will be on endosymbioses. So symbioses. So our next step is to consider endosymbioses. Now, endosymbioses are symbioses. They just happen to be ones in which one of the species lives inside of the cell or cells of another species. Now, the most familiar of the endosymbionts, or at least derivatives of endosymbionts, are the mitochondria and the chloroplast, or more generally, plastids. There are, however, variations on both what mitochondria are and what plastids are. And in addition, there are a substantial number of other bacteria, especially, that serve as endosymbionts of other organisms. And they play various roles in the functioning of these other organisms. So this part of this lecture on symbioses is on endosymbioses. So endosymbioses. So the concept of serial endosymbiosis is our explanation for why eukaryotic cells often have more than one endosymbiont or derivative organelle that was derived from an endosymbiont living in their cytoplasms. And so what we have over here on the left is a prokaryotic cell. And there is a suggestion of where the endomembrane system came from, including the formation of a nucleus, whether or not those actually predated the acquisition of the first endosymbiont is an open question. But I draw your attention to right here where we have the acquisition of a mitochondrion. The mitochondrion was established presumably before other endosymbionts were present in the cytoplasm of eukaryotic cells, which is to say that the mitochondrial eukaryotes seemingly predated those that have plastids, the ones that are able to display cellular respiration, that is the use of oxygen and making their ATP, seems to have predated the ability of eukaryotic cells to photosynthesize by having acquired a chloroplast. But in the idea of serial endosymbiosis, the idea of endosymbiotic events have followed one after another. The mitochondrial eukaryotes, some of them anyway, acquired plastids. The original plastid was simply a cyanobacterium, but there are variations on the concept of plastids that have arisen since then. And so once we have acquired these plastids, we now have a eukaryotic cell that has two endosymbionts living in its cytoplasm, the mitochondria and something else, in this case, the plastid. And in fact, the idea that there are other kinds of endosymbionts out there besides mitochondria and plastids follows the same general rule that basically you start with a mitochondrial eukaryote, and in some capacity that eukaryote acquires a second endosymbiont and thus acquires that endosymbiont serially. There also are cases, although they're rare, where prokaryotic cells living today in fact can carry endosymbionts in their cytoplasm. So this is a little model for the acquisition of mitochondria. You basically have a eukaryotic cell. Here I'm saying that the nucleus predates the mitochondrion. This cell would, of course, been an obligate fermenter since cellular respiration was not invented by eukaryotic cells, but instead was acquired by eukaryotic cells in the guise of their acquisition of mitochondria. And so what we have is this pre-mitochondrial eukaryote. It then has acquired, in some capacity, a mitochondrion. So that's the pre-mitochondrial eukaryote. And where did this mitochondrion come from? Well, it was some sort of aerobic chemoheterotrophic bacterium. At the point of acquisition of the mitochondrion, it may or may not have been free living at this point. It may in fact have been a parasitic bacterium at this point, but the jury is still a little bit out on exactly what the mitochondrion's immediate predecessor consisted of. And so once you have acquired this mitochondrion, this bacterium that now lives in the cytoplasm of the eukaryotic host, we call this a mitochondrial eukaryote. So it turns out that just as there are a diversity of plastids out there, there are a diversity of mitochondria out there. And in fact, there are a number of organelles that we don't even describe as mitochondria that may very well have derived from mitochondria. So mitochondria are the main sites of biological energy generation in eukaryotes. These organelles are remnants of a bacterial endosymbiont that took up residence inside a host cell over 1,500 million years ago, so 1.5 billion years ago. As an aside, the Earth is approximately 4.2, 4.3 billion years old. And this means that the Earth was in existence approximately 3 billion years, give or take, before the invention of the mitochondrion. And in fact, prokaryotic cells have been around for approximately 2 billion years prior to the invention of the mitochondrion. So really, the majority of the Earth's history consisted of organisms that did not have mitochondria. It was only relatively late in the game that eukaryotes acquired the ability to display cellular respiration, that is, to use oxygen in their generation of ATP. So this is a relatively modern occurrence, even though, of course, we think of it 1.5 billion years ago as being ancient indeed. So comparative genomic studies suggest that the mitochondrion is monophyletic in origin. So to remind you what that means, it means that all mitochondria can trace their genetics, their evolution, back to a single proto-mitochondrion and a single endosymbiotic event in which that mitochondrion was acquired. So there were pre-mitochondrial eukaryotes or pre-mitochondrial pre-eukaryotes, and there was an acquisition of a mitochondrion, and every single mitochondria that is around today is derived from that mitochondrion. And in addition to that, there's likely the other things that are mitochondrial-like that also derive from that original mitochondrion. So thus, the original mitochondrial endosymbiont has evolved independently in anaerobic and aerobic environments that are inhabited by diverse eukaryotic lineages. This process has resulted in a collection of morphologically, genetically, and functionally heterogeneous organelle variants that include anaerobic and aerobic mitochondria. These things are known as hydrogenosomes and mitosomes. These are the two latter ones are anaerobic variations on mitochondria. If mitochondria are the way that eukaryotic cells utilize oxygen in order to make ATP, and there are eukaryotic cells that in fact don't utilize oxygen to make ATP, it stands to reason that those eukaryotic cells that don't utilize oxygen to make ATP either lost their mitochondria or possess mitochondria that are unable to utilize oxygen to make ATP, and the hydrogenosomes and the mitosomes are thought to be those mitochondria. A mitosome is an apparently mitochondrially derived organelle. The mitosomes essentially, or at least sort of, are hydrogenosomes that do not generate molecular hydrogen. So basically, there is diversity in terms of the descendants of mitochondria. Although whether or not the hydrogenosomes and mitosomes really are mitochondrial descendants is a little difficult to tease out because the hydrogenosomes and the mitosomes actually don't have genomes of their own, contrasting the mitochondria, which have a remnant of their original bacterial chromosome. So again, we have a pre-mitochondrial eukaryote. It may or may not have been a eukaryote. And then what I have here are different scenarios for the acquisition of the mitochondrion. And so in this first scenario, what we have is the uptake of a bacterium as food. So this is phagocytosis. This is the phagosome. And when we talked about you are what you eat, we said that these phagosomes can break open occasionally and the contents can find their way into the cytoplasm. DNA, if it's in the phagosome, can then potentially find its way to the nucleus. In this case, what we're talking about is accidental breaking open of the phagosome, releasing its bacterial content in this case, and the bacterium then takes up residence in the eukaryotic cytoplasm and ultimately becomes the mitochondrion. So this is our proto-endosymbiont in a phagosome. Actually, it need not be a phagolysosome. It could just be the phagosome immediately as acquired prior to its fusing with the lysosome. And then here we have this accidental release from the phagosome or phagolysosome of this proto-endosymbiont into the cytoplasm. And alternatively, we could have had retention of the phagosome membrane as the outer membrane of the mitochondria. Mitochondria have two membranes that derive from gram-negative bacteria, so it makes sense that both membranes could have come from gram-negative bacteria. But in at least certain circumstances, it also makes sense that the outer membrane of an endosymbiont, instead of deriving from a bacterium, derives instead from the endomembrane system of the acquiring eukaryote. So this is an alternative scenario where we basically have a bacterial pathogen that has found its way into the cytoplasm and it displays sufficiently low virulence, or as we talked about in the previous part of the lecture, perhaps it's applied to its host some kind of advantage, some kind of function that increased the host fitness when the host was carrying this pathogen and thus allowing a persistence within that host of the pathogen, the persistence of an intact host. It could very well be that the function supplied was cellular respiration, was the ability to make ATP using oxygen as a final electron acceptor. And then from this not commensalism, not mutualism, but instead parasitism, we could have had evolution of a commensalism and ultimately evolution of a mutualism. And at that point, we could describe this proto-endosymbiont as a mitochondrion, or at least its forerunner. And then finally, we have this potential that perhaps there's this uptake, a temporary uptake of essentially slaves. Like we saw with those photosynthetic sea slugs, where they can take up chloroplasts. The chloroplasts, although they're able to persist within the tissues of the sea slug, they don't last forever. One could conceive of a eukaryotic cell taking up a free living bacterium, that the intention is to have that free living bacterium in its presence only temporarily, in the cytoplasm of the host cell only temporarily, but eventually the cell is able to come up with some kind of scheme where it's able to persist within the host cell to the mutual benefit of both, and thus you have the proto-mitochondrion. Or indeed, these are also scenarios for the acquisition of more than just mitochondria. You could have acquisition of cyanobacteria and similar by similar mechanisms, for example, or other kinds of endosymbionts. The point is that there is, in fact, a diversity of scenarios by which a eukaryotic cell could acquire an endosymbiont. And we're really not certain which of these mechanisms was involved in the acquisition of the mitochondria to begin with. So mitochondrial diversity, mitochondrial genome is a remnant of the original bacterial endosymbiont that gave rise to the current mitochondria. The original interaction between the endosymbiont and host resulted in transfer of endosymbiont genes to the host nucleus. So this is a common theme when talking about endosymbiosis, is that because of mechanisms like you are what you eat, if there's an accident that results in release of the chromosome of the endosymbiont into the host cytoplasm, that DNA can potentially make its way into the nucleus and integrate into the genome of the nucleus that's found in the nucleus of the eukaryotic host. And when that happens, ultimately those genes may find themselves expressed, and they may find themselves targeted back to the mitochondrion. And once that occurs, because the genome in the nucleus is more stable evolutionarily because of lower mutation rates and various mechanisms that ward off Mueller's ratchet, there is a tendency for a replacement of the mitochondrial gene with the nuclear gene, and then the mitochondrial gene is simply lost to genetic drift, to genomic erosion. And thus we have essentially a ratcheting of the genes that were found originally in the mitochondrion or other kind of endosymbiont being replaced by nuclear genes that in fact were derived from the genes originally found in the endosymbiont. In addition to this, these genes that are derived from the endosymbiont can find their way into the nucleus and take up other functions within the eukaryotic cell, not just the production of gene products that are targeted back to the endosymbiont. So the original interaction between the endosymbiont and host resulted in the transfer of endosymbiont genes to the host nucleus and the irreversible loss of redundant genes, which is to say the loss of genes from the endosymbiont. The observation that mitochondrial genomes vary very enormously in size and gene content suggests that gene transfer might be dependent on some environmental conditions. Reclamona's americana, a freshwater protozoan, contains the least derived mitochondrial genome with the largest coding capacity and encodes 97 genes in its genome that is just over 69 kilobases in size, or at least when this paragraph was written, it was the largest. At the other end of the spectrum, Plasmodium falciparum, the causative agent of malaria, contains the smallest reported mitochondrial genome, which encodes just 5 genes in a 6 kilobase element. Under certain conditions, this reductive tendency may result in eventual displacement of all mitochondrial genes from the organelle, as suggested by the apparent absence of an organelle or genome in diverse mitochondrial-related organelles, like the hydrogenosomes. And so what we have here are two scenarios for the origin of a diversity of mitochondrial-like organelles. So we'll start with the lower of the scenario. So what you're seeing here is the acquisition of the proto-mitochondrion. We have this transfer of genes to the nucleus and the loss of genes from the mitochondrion. So the mitochondrion is gradually decreasing in its genetic repertoire, and the necessary genes for its functioning as an organelle are replaced by gene products that are produced by these nuclear genes. So what we have going down to here is the idea that this aerobic organism could very well have lost its mitochondrion, and that mitochondrion could have been replaced by some other kind of endosymbiont that serves some other purpose other than aerobic respiration in the resulting eukaryote. And then ultimately, the same kind of thing could have happened where you had transfer of genes to the nucleus and loss of genes in the endosymbiont. And then that was taken fully to the point where, in fact, you had a complete loss entirely of the genes that are associated with the endosymbionts or presumptive endosymbionts that we called hydrogenosomes or mitosomes. And so in anaerobic lineages of eukaryotes, it could be that the mitochondria-like things, in fact, are not a direct descendant of mitochondria. But in order for this to happen, you have to have essentially two events occurring. You had to start with a mitochondrial eukaryote, at least we assume, either that or a remnant of a eukaryote that was pre-mitochondrial. And then you had to have loss of the mitochondria and a replacement with a second endosymbiont. The preferred inference is that there were fewer steps involved in the generation of the mitosome and the hydrogenosome. And here we have instead the loss of all of the genes from the mitochondria, the original mitochondria, to generate the hydrogenosome and the mitosome. And then in addition, we have persistence of the mitochondria with genes in the mitochondrial or mitochondriate eukaryotes, as shown here. So this is a simpler scheme, and the similarities between hydrogenosomes and mitosomes suggest that it may be, and together with mitochondria, suggest that it may be correct. That in fact we started out with a pre-mitochondrial eukaryote, there was an acquisition of a mitochondrion, and then every single eukaryote from that point on evolved from that mitochondrial, that original mitochondrial eukaryote. So this is an assumption here, in this hypothesis in the top here, of a mitochondrial monophyly. That is, that all mitochondria are ultimately related to each other and can trace their roots back to an original mitochondrial event, and all mitochondria-like organelles, the hydrogenosomes and the mitosomes, also can trace their origin back to that original mitochondrial event. And what we have down here is an assumption, okay, not necessarily of a mitochondrial polyphyly, but that the dominant endosymbiont found in both aerobic and anaerobic lineages of eukaryotes were derived from different endosymbiotic events. So I guess this better is stated as an assumption of a primary endosymbiont, endosymbial polyphyly. In other words, that the primary endosymbiont found among all eukaryotes was formed in at least two different occasions. That there was the acquisition of the mitochondrion, and then there was an acquisition of this other thing. So there is not a monophyly, a single origin of the primary endosymbiont in eukaryotes. Evidence suggests that mitochondrion-related organelles are a collection of biochemically and morphologically diverse organelles that have independent evolutionary histories, but that share a common origin similar to the mitochondria. In other words, this hypothesis shown here. And so then there are the plastids. So the plastids, the one we're most familiar with is the chloroplast, but there are a bunch of different other types of plastids out there. The amyloplast, for example, is where starch amylose is stored. And we have other kinds of plastids here that do other kinds of things. And basically, they are all derived one from the other, such that we have a single plastid acquisition step, a monophyly for plastid acquisition, at least the primary acquisition of plastids, excuse me, from cyanobacteria, the acquisition of a cyanobacterium as a plastid, and that you just have a physiological and morphological interrelatedness, a developmental interrelatedness of all of the plastids that otherwise can be found, for example, in plants. So plastids are a class of membrane-bound organelles found both in plants and algae cells, although, again, I have to caution that not all plastids are identical to one another. And in fact, although it's likely that there is a original chloroplast monophyly, there are other kinds of chloroplasts out there that are more complicated than the chloroplast that, for example, is found in plants. So in plants, these different plastids may differentiate into several forms depending upon which function they need to play in a cell. In other words, depending upon what kind of cell is present and what are the needs of the cell, what kind of cell they're present in, a root cell, for example, versus a leaf cell, and what are the needs of the cell that they're present in. So serial endosymbiosis is how we describe the acquisition, for example, of the mitochondrion followed by a plastid like chloroplast. There's also a concept known as secondary endosymbiosis, and this is a different concept, although it plays into the serial endosymbiosis scheme. What you have is the acquisition of a mitochondrion, which is shown right here. So you have a mitochondrial eukaryote, and then you have acquisition of an additional endosymbiont, and in this case, the additional endosymbiont is the cyanobacterium. The cyanobacterium A, as they're calling it. And it's this green thing, and it's acquired here. They're showing by phagocytosis, and then you have a plastid, and that's called a primary endosymbiosis event. It's primary because what's being acquired in this endosymbiotic event is a prokaryotic cell rather than a eukaryotic cell. Now, there are examples of secondary endosymbiotic events, in fact, common examples of this. And what's going on here is that now we have created an algae. An algae is a eukaryotic cell that possesses a mitochondrion and also possesses a plastid, and it photosynthesizes. The algae in itself can be acquired by another eukaryotic cell, which is what's being shown here. In fact, this is the non-photosynthetic eukaryotic cell here, this heterotroph C, and it's acquiring, again, they're indicating it by phagocytosis, a algae cell. And now what we have is, at least initially, a plastid that consists of the primary endosymbiotic event, the cyanobacterium, also the other eukaryotic cell that originally acquired that cyanobacterium, including its mitochondria and its nucleus, all serving together as a plastid for this larger organism. Now, with time, there is a degeneration of this eukaryotic cell, and by and large, we have losses of the nucleus and losses of the mitochondria, although there are some exceptions with regard to nucleus and nuclear genes. And then we have the same kind of thing going on throughout all of this that we saw with the mitochondria, where we have movement of genes from the endosymbiont into the nucleus, and then the replacement of those genes with nuclear genes. So this is showing a scheme that's indicating which algae, in fact, are products of primary endosymbiotic events, and which algae are products of secondary endosymbiotic events. So red algae and green algae together represent the primary endosymbiotic algae. These are our most basic of algae. The green algae are adapted by and large to more shallow conditions, and the red algae are adapted by and large to more deeper conditions, less light, more light. It's actually not surprising that the plants evolved from the green algae because the green algae are adapted to being as close to being on land as a algae can be, that is, basically at the surface or near the surface of a body of water. But then these green algae and red algae have been acquired by other eukaryotes to give rise to the brown algae and also the euglenoids down here. So the brown algae, the diatoms, the golden algae, these are all associated with these secondary endosymbiotic events. In other words, their plastids were actually, in this case, red algae that were acquired by these eukaryotes and then took up residence as a photosynthetic organelle in these organisms. The complete genome of the thermophilic red algae Cyanidiocean merulae provides further evidence that all plastids derive from a single endosymbiotic event more than 600 million years ago. So the idea here is that this primary symbiotic event, the acquisition of the original cyanobacterium, the original chloroplast, took place about 600 million years ago and took place once. And that resulting plastid-containing eukaryote then gave rise to the red algae and the green algae, which of course then gave rise to the brown algae, etc. In addition, note this 600 million years ago. So this means that the mitochondria seems to have predated the chloroplast by well over a half a billion years. So it was only 600 million years ago. Now we're getting close to a tenth of the age of the Earth, or an eighth of the age of the Earth, that we have had these algae that are eukaryotic and have chloroplasts. We think of these things as ancient. Of course, the algae eventually gave rise to the green plants. We think of the green plants as ancient, and yet only about one-eighth of the Earth's history have there been eukaryotes that have had chloroplasts, at least ones that have persisted to the present day. Persisted, that is, in terms of their lineages. So this turns out to not be quite 100% correct. There actually are primary endosymbiotic events that have resulted in the generation of algae that are other than the original formation of what we know of as the chloroplast, but these are rather rare. So this then leads us to our tertiary endosymbiotic events. In a tertiary endosymbiotic event, what we have is a cyanobacterium that's been acquired by a eukaryotic cell. That eukaryotic cell, that algae, has then been acquired by a second eukaryotic cell. And that second eukaryotic cell has then been acquired by a third eukaryotic cell. And so what we have is a eukaryotic cell surrounding a eukaryotic cell surrounding a eukaryotic cell surrounding a original prokaryotic cell, serving as the plastid, serving as the chloroplast of these dinoflagellates. Dinoflagellates are a type of eukaryotic algae. Now, whereas we see a great deal of degeneration of the plastids in the primary and secondary endosymbiotic events, where we have loss of the genomes associated with both the original prokaryote, the cyanobacterium, and also the algae in the case of the secondary endosymbiosis. With these tertiary endosymbiotic events, however, we don't have quite the same degree of degeneration, at least not always. But in fact, the situation is even more complicated than that. So things are even stranger than that. Here we have a mitochondrial eukaryote that is gaining a plastid by obtaining a cyanobacterium. So this is the initial derivation of a chloroplast, the origin of a chloroplast. And we have a differentiation of this original algae into two different types, the red algae versus the green algae. Now, the green algae have been involved in a secondary endosymbiotic event that had given rise to euglenoids, which contain a plastid that is derived from a green algae, which in turn had a plastid that was derived from a cyanobacterium. In addition, the green algae gave rise to the green plants. The red algae are just what's happened to them is just strange. We have the red algae themselves are a consequence of a primary endosymbiotic event. Secondary endosymbiotic event is the engulfing of a red algae by a eukaryotic cell, presumably lacking in a plastid already. And this gives rise to a diversity of different algae. But the root to that diversity, and that many of these, in fact, are not even algae, really makes it complicated. So these red algae, in some lineages, the red algae serving as the plastid, that has actually been lost. And in one of these lineages, what we have is acquisition of a green algae as the plastid. In this lineage up here, what we have is the acquisition actually of a cyanobacterium as the plastid. Up here, the Straminopoli, this includes the brown algae and the golden algae. And so these are common algae. Kelp is a brown algae that are products of a secondary endosymbiotic event. So too the dinoflagellates, but we'll get back to them in a second. The ciliates, now, so we don't think of ciliates as algae at all, but they potentially, in fact, have been derived from a secondary endosymbiotic event where a red algae was acquired and then lost. And the apicomplexans, now this includes the malarial parasite, and although not all of them have a red algae endosymbiont, a plastid, some of them, in fact, do. Now, the dinoflagellate, this is even stranger. So over here, what we have are the tertiary endosymbiotic events. And what we have going on here is actually a loss of the original red algae as the plastid and its replacement with all sorts of strange things, including a green algae as a plastid. And so these replacements basically are secondary endosymbiotic events that are now giving rise to a plastid unto itself. And these include the diatom as the new plastid, as well as these cryptomonads as the new plastid. And so these diatoms just have a diversity of plastids that have come from a number of different places, including the acquisition of the plastid by secondary endosymbiosis and the acquisition of the plastid by tertiary endosymbiosis. So this is a schematic trying to show what all of these various relationships involve, and in addition, a new one. And so what we have here is a gram-positive cell, which may very well have gotten together with a second gram-positive cell to give rise to the original gram-negative cell. And among the gram-negative cells are the progenitors to the mitochondria, as well as the progenitors to the cyanobacteria. Here we have the acquisition of a mitochondrion, and then we have in the mitochondrial eukaryote acquisition of a plastid. So that's a primary endosymbiotic event, although this is serial endosymbiosis, going from a mitochondrial eukaryote to a eukaryotic algae. And then this product of a primary endosymbiotic event, these in turn can serve as the plastids, and this is secondary endosymbiosis, what we're seeing here. Now, you see a great deal of degeneration of these secondary endosymbiotic plastids, although there is some remnant of a nuclear genome in at least some of these plastids. And then this secondary endosymbiotic event. So what we've got here is the nucleus, the mitochondria, and then a plastid that consists of something that did have a nucleus and a mitochondria and a cyanobacterium as its plastid. Plastid in a sense within a plastid. These can be acquired in a tertiary endosymbiotic event where you've got a nucleus, you've got a mitochondria, you've got an organism that has inside of it at least had been a nucleus and had been a mitochondria and had been a cyanobacteria going all the way back to here. And in fact, in these dinoflagellates that have that are products of tertiary endosymbiotic events, it's even stranger in that these dinoflagellates had been products of secondary endosymbiotic events, but they've somehow lost this plasmid and replaced it with an entire secondary endosymbiotic product. And in addition to that, in these dinoflagellates, the plastid itself is much less degenerate than you see in these other examples, the secondary endosymbiotic event consequence and the primary endosymbiotic event consequence, where you actually see intact nuclear genomes in these plastids. So the inference is that in these tertiary endosymbiotic events, at least some of them were catching the endosymbiotic event fairly early in its evolution, where you've had the acquisition of the plastid, but you have yet to lose the plastid as a consequence of redundancy with what's already going on in the cell. Alternatively, it's possible that when you are having such complexity in the plastid alone, that's the consequence of a tertiary endosymbiotic event, that it's just so complex, it's difficult for these individual plastids to, in fact, easily lose their genes. It might be difficult for the genes to migrate to the nucleus. Who knows? It might be difficult for the genes to move, or the gene products to move back from the nucleus all the way into the the original cyanobacterium remnant that's found inside of these things. But in any case, we've got this strange situation where we have the acquisition of a algae that itself was the product of an acquisition of an algae serving as the plastid inside of these dinoflagellate algae. So this is our primary endosymbiotic event, the acquisition of the cyanobacterium. This is our secondary endosymbiotic event, the acquisition of a eukaryotic algae as a plastid. And then this is the product of our tertiary endosymbiotic event, the acquisition of the product of the secondary endosymbiotic event as our plastid. So here we have an even stranger sequence of events. What we have is a heterotroph, a mitochondrial eukaryote. So there's the mitochondrion. And what we're seeing here is serial endosymbiosis, so the acquisition of a plastid by the mitochondrion. The acquisition of the plastid is our familiar cyanobacterium, so this is a primary endosymbiotic event. The consequence of this primary endosymbiotic event is eventually the diversification into green algae plus the red algae. So this is our familiar story up to this point. One of the things that's being added within this scheme, however, is the acquisition of a chlamydia early on in this lineage. Now, chlamydia is a bacterium, and chlamydia, in fact, is an intracellular parasite. It is the same chlamydia, at least at the genus level, that is responsible for the disease that we know as chlamydia, the sexually transmitted disease, Chlamydia trachomatis. Is the cause of that disease in us. And so this is a parasite. It is able to gain entry into eukaryotic cells, and so it's not that surprising that it's been around a long time and it was able to infect, or at least a progenitor to, was able to infect these early on ancestors to the green algae and the red algae. And this chlamydia is gone, but apparently some of its genes may have found their way into the nucleus, and in fact, a signature of those genes can be identified today. So we have what we can describe as a presumptive chlamydia infection that led to presumably a long-term interaction that resulted in transfer of genes from that chlamydia into the nuclear genome of the progenitor to the red and green algae, and then subsequent loss of the chlamydia. Now, whether the chlamydia was serving as a parasite or an endosymbiont, who knows? But what we have at this point is the product of a primary endosymbiotic event with a nucleus, a mitochondrion, a plastid that's derived from a cyanobacterium, and also perhaps genes from a chlamydia. Now, the secondary endosymbiotic event is the acquisition, in fact, of the red algae, which we're seeing right here, by another heterotrophic mitochondrial eukaryote. And this red algae then degenerates into a plastid with the loss, either complete or partial, of the nuclear genes and loss of the mitochondria to form the plastid. So this is here a product of a secondary endosymbiotic event. This stromatopoly includes the brown algae and also the golden algae and various other things. In addition, in the diatoms, there is evidence that not only was there acquisition of a red algae, but also acquisition of a green algae. And an inference that can be made is that what we had was a heterotroph that acquired a green algae in a secondary endosymbiotic event. There was then migration of genes from that green algae into the nuclear genome. And then there was loss of that green algae and replacement of it with a red algae. And thus, you now have the diatoms with a red algae as a remnant, as their plastid, but with remnants of green algae genes in their nuclear genome, and also remnants of chlamydia genes in their nuclear genome. This idea of there being this sequential loss and then gain of plastids is a similar story to what we talked about with the dinoflagellates in the case of the tertiary endosymbiosis, where the dinoflagellates usually have this red algae as their plastid, or at least the remnant of a red algae, which in fact in some lineages has been lost and has been replaced by other kinds of algae, including green algae. So, very complicated interactions between eukaryotic cells and prokaryotic cells over the span of evolution of the mitochondrial eukaryotes. And in some of these algae, there have been many different endosymbionts that have passed through them, including perhaps a chlamydia and also a green algae and also a red algae. Some of those genes made their way into the nuclear genome and persisted long enough for at least for us to have a hint that these various other things were present within these cells at some point in time. And some of them persist as essentially organelles within these cells, which is the case of the plastid that's derived from a red algae.